Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
Members are delegates, co-delegates of the party that were invited to this convention have endorsed her as the torchbearer for the People's Party coming to about that election of 2025.
Malawi's opposition People's Party chooses former President Joyce Banda as its presidential candidate for next year's general election.
We found that there are reasonable grounds to believe that both SAF and RSF and their respective allies have committed the war crimes of violence against life and person, in particular murder of all kinds, mutilation, cruel treatment and torture.
United Nations investigators accuse Sudan's warring parties and militias of human rights violations.
Public involvement in our electoral processes allows for more oversight. Okay, and it also tells us that the Electoral Commission genuinely is willing and ready to conduct a free, fair and transparent elections. So these are the things we are looking at.
And a Ghanaian civil society group expresses concern about the integrity of the coming general election in December. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Malawi, the opposition People's Party has chosen former President Joyce Banda as its presidential candidate for the coming general election. At the party's convention to elect new representatives of the national executive to lead the group in the next polls, Malawi's first female president was chosen to be the presidential candidate on Saturday. Banda expressed confidence in policies her next government will implement to resolve the challenges facing the country. The former president faces a stiff challenge in the presidential contest with incumbent presidents Lazarus Chakwera and former president Arthur Peter Mutharika. Parliamentarian Axon Kalaili is the newly elected National Publicity Secretary of the People's Party. He tells me the next aim of the party is to wrestle power from President Chakwera at the polls next year.
Yeah, it's a convention that happens every after 5 years to renew the mandate of the people that have been ushered into office. So we had this mandate today, which started on 6 September. The members are delegates, we call delegates of the party that were invited to this convention. I endorsed her as the torchbearer for the People's Party coming to a party election of 2025.
What are the prospects of former President Joyce Banda winning the presidency of the Republic of Malawi?
You know, the time she was president of this country, she did a number of things that changed the lives of people and the direction of the country. So some people have the same expectation because it's the chiefs, the people who have been calling her to come back to the presidency for several times, and she has been turning down. But now after the overwhelming call for her to come, she has now accepted that, and she wants to stand 2025. But based on the achievement that she did when she was a president, you know, for the past for 2 years, from 2012 to 2014, that particular time.
Now, Axon, the question some Malawians are asking is, it will be a repeat of two main presidential candidates, incumbent president Dr. Lazarus Chakwera and former president Arthur Peter Mutharika, and they don't see any pathway of your presidential candidate, Dr. Joyce Banda, of defeating these two leading candidates because it was one and two between them. What say you?
No, it's a different direction. What happened at that particular time cannot happen today. Because at that particular time, it was different because some of the people, they have never been, they were not in position at that particular time. But now, if you analyze what she did at that particular time and other things, you might see that she has an opportunity that she can deliver, because she delivered and the Malawians have hope in her without even comparing her to anyone. But as a president who was once the president of this country, she performed tremendously to the development and to the improvement of people's lives in this country.
Asking political analysts say the incumbent president, Lazarus Chakwera, has the power of incumbency and state resources. Will your candidate or your party consider an alliance? Because some are suggesting that without an alliance, it's very difficult to dislodge or wrestle power from the ruling party. What do you say to that?
Yeah, you know, as I've said that today we have elected new members into the office, and these new members in the office, they now have the mandate whether to take the direction that you are suggesting of the alliance whatsoever. But as People's Party, what we have done today is that the party is going to 2025 election with torchbearer Her Excellency Dr. Joyce Banda.
So, in your view, what is the overarching message to the people of Malawi as they prepare to go to the elections? And two, what should they expect from this convention moving forward?
If you read from our theme of this convention, it is saying restoring hope and building brighter future together. It means that there's a hope that maybe has been lost in some of Malawians, that we need to restore that. So in doing that, we are going to move together with Malawians. As I've said, that there are a number of things that we, if you put on the tick box, the number of things that she did extremely well that Malawians are still remembering up to now. So we are basing on that. That's why there has been calls from several people across the country, chiefs and other people, to call her to come back and reclaim that hope.
So you are confident that Dr. Joyce Banda will be the next president of Malawi?
This is what we have agreed today. This is the direction that we are taking.
Parliamentarian Axen Kalaili is the newly elected National Publicity Secretary of the People's Party. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. In Uganda, the Deputy Lord Mayor of Kampala says the members of the Opposition Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, continue to seek justice for those recently arrested in Kenya. Doris Nyanjura also says the authorities in Uganda violated the fundamental rights of the citizens who were arrested in Kenya and deported back to Uganda. Her remarks come after Nyanjura and a parliamentarian were arrested following a demonstration near the Kenyan High Commission in Uganda. Other members of the party were also arrested in Kenya and deported to Uganda for what Kampala says was terrorism training. Critics say the opposition members of the FDC breached the law and should be prosecuted. But Deputy Lord Mayor Dorin Nyanjura tells me that the FDC will petition international organizations, including the United Nations, and use all means to pursue justice for the detained opposition supporters.
We marched to the Kenyan High Commission here in Uganda to take there our protest note. Unfortunately, at the first attempt, 14 of us were arrested and were taken to court, and some of our colleagues were remanded to Luzira Maximum Prison. So what eventually happened, we found our way of ensuring that our protest note reaches the High Commission here in Kampala. And yes, that was eventually done. Unfortunately, up to date, we have not received any communication. We have not received any response from the Commission of Kenya here in Kampala. So we are not letting go. We are not giving up the fight. And now what we have resorted to is taking this to the East African community. And we also intend to involve the UN. We are going to leave no stone unturned, but we are also dragging the Kenyan government to court.
What are the prospects of success? Because Kenya is a sovereign nation, and the report is that these people are going to be trained to come and destabilize Uganda, for which reason they are being charged accordingly. So what are the prospects of success of the next line of action you decide to take?
But you see, these are the questions that we are asking ourselves. If Kenya is a sovereign state, then how did the Ugandan police, how did the Ugandan military go to Chisumu, break into the rooms of our activists, confiscate them, torture them, and return to Uganda. So there's nothing sovereign about that. There's nothing independent about that. And, you know, this takes us back to what the Gen Zs in Kenya were complaining about. The Gen Zs in Kenya during their demonstration stated that the Ugandan security forces were participating in arresting and torturing them. So the incident that happened of the Uganda security forces breaking into the rooms in Kisumu, arresting and torturing our activists on gunpoint, only proved that. For us, we are saying we are going to use all peaceful means necessary and we are not going to leave any stone unturned.
Doreen, the question that your critics are asking is, if you're going to take this legal route, why are you not respecting the rules and the laws of Uganda? Because they said you were arrested, you were supposed to appear in court, you and your colleagues refused to appear in court, and a bench warrant has been issued to your arrest. And they said you are one of those people who like to create confusion, and then you complain when the law is applied or being faulted.
I think I'm one of the law-abiding citizens and one of the institutions that I respect regardless of some of the shortcomings is really the courts. I respect the courts. So by the time one fails to appear in court, I know myself I couldn't make it today in court because I was undergoing some challenges. My daughter is unwell. I have a 5-month-old daughter. She's not feeling well. I know the Honorable Semuj was on official duties, but we are represented in court by our lawyer and our other colleagues were present. So I'm aware that legal summons have been issued, and we are going to be in court on 2nd October. God willing, inshallah. If there's nothing that will hinder me, if nothing comes up on that day, I am going to definitely be in court. So it's not true that I was absent in court because I was present through my lawyer that communicated to the magistrate the reasons as to why I wasn't physically present on bail by the High Court.
Doris Nyanjura is the Deputy Lord Mayor of Kampala. She spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. The Inspector General of the Ugandan Police is calling on anti-graft agencies to step up their fight to root out corruption. Abbas Biakagaba says the public is frustrated because high-profile individuals accused of corruption go unpunished. He called for more collaboration between all the government agencies to effectively combat financial malfeasance and wrongdoing. But Marlon Agaba, the executive director of the Anti-Corruption Coalition, tells me that the police chief appears to be only paying lip service to the fight against graft. He adds that there must be a political commitment from President Yoweri Museveni and his government for the effort to root out corruption to succeed.
Yeah, that is the usual rhetoric. Government has been saying that they are going to go after the big fish, but we haven't seen it happening. And for us, for these issues, we know that the Inspector General of Government and even the Director of Public Prosecutions, they don't so much power and say in terms of the big fish that get charged in corruption cases. We know that in most cases, the president has a lot of power in terms of who gets prosecuted, especially in the political elite. So I would say that is more of talking to appease the public, but in terms of active substance, in terms of investigating high-level political corruption, nothing much would be done because they've been saying before that they're going after the big fish, but we don't see that happening. In cases that have been happening, having corruption at parliament, where the Speaker of Parliament is involved, and we don't see anybody getting arrested at Parliament, just a few members of Parliament, but the Speaker doesn't get arrested. We had a scandal of stealing iron sheets from the people of Karamoja, and we had the Vice President, we had the Speaker, we had the Prime Minister, and other high-ranking government officials involved, but we didn't see them getting arrested. So this is just lip service.
Marlon, the Inspector General of Police, Abbas Biakagaba, said that the members of the public are eagerly waiting for officers in the criminal justice system to target high-profile corrupt people. Is this assertion correct?
One, of course, the public is always expectant, and every time the president has come out to speak against corruption, we have been expectant. And like the few examples I've given, when there were a few arrests happening, we thought that finally the high-ranking government officials were apprehended, but we didn't see that happening. So the Inspector General of Government come out now and say that they're expecting that and they want to support that. I still believe that that is a deep service, because, like, one, the Inspector General of Police doesn't have so much power when it comes to corruption cases. Even the Inspector General of Government, we have seen over time that the Inspector General of Government is also powerless when it comes to cases. Some of these cases are determined and decided at the highest power in the presidency, in terms of who gets charged and who doesn't get charged. So in terms of speaking and making utterances, we are used to that. It has happened before. People speaking, giving lip service to fighting corruption, but when it comes to the actual fighting of corruption, we only see the small fish being arrested and taken to court.
A lot of people have wondered why the institutions that have been established, including the anti-graft institutions, even under the presidency and the IGG, have not been effective in going after so-called the big fish. And some people are saying what Inspector General of Police is saying is a welcoming development and should be put to use. Why are you so pessimistic about it, they wonder?
Because corruption is so entrenched, and the system of governance we have is a patronage system that works based on rewards, that works based on corruption. And we have seen this happening over and over again. For instance, we have so many ministers that are given ministries to reward regions for political support. We have so many presidential advisors. We have so many resident district commissioners, because it is a system of rewarding. It's a system of patronage. We are seeing an increase in, for instance, supplementary budgets. We are seeing an increase in budget-based corruption that is appropriated, that is budgeted and is approved with approval of the presidency. So corruption is part and parcel of the governance system in Uganda. It's part of the patronage system. So that's why we are very much pessimistic if someone comes out and says they are quite sure they are going to stamp out corruption, because we know it's part of the government, it's part of the system, it is quite entrenched, and the president has tolerated this to go on over time. Unless he really changes that stand, then these other public officials are just paying lip service.
So for anti-corruption activists like yourself, what does this make your work?
What we have haven't been having as a country is real leadership from the top, and I mean the presidency, because we're in a country where the president is quite powerful, and the president, the tone that the president sets, not just in terms of words, but also in terms of actions, helps in terms of determining the rest when it comes to fighting corruption. So we have really lacked clear leadership in terms of fighting corruption, and that is what we need. If there is a clear zero tolerance to corruption in terms of words and also in terms of action, then that can trickle down to all the different departments of government.
Marlon Agaba is the executive director of the Anti-Corruption Coalition. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Elder care can come as a job that one did not apply for, anticipate, or even desire to do. However, whether a responsibility or an obligation, it is a task that must be done by a family member or a professional to assist the elderly. Today, we examine the challenges as well as resources available to best care for the elderly in our family or community.
Join the conversation on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on the Voice of America.
United Nations investigators accuse Sudan's warring parties and their allied militias of numerous human rights violations that may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. This first report by the Independent International Fact-Finding Mission for Sudan will be submitted to the UN Human Rights Council next week. For viewing, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The report from a United Nations panel presents a harrowing account of major violations. They include indiscriminate and direct air strikes and shelling against civilians, schools, hospitals, communication networks, and vital water and electricity supplies. Mona Rishmawi is an expert member of the International Fact-Finding Mission. She says neither the Sudanese armed forces nor paramilitary rapid support forces have clean hands in the conflict, which began nearly 18 months ago.
We found that there are reasonable grounds to believe that both SAF and RSF and their respective allies have committed the war crimes of violence against life and person, in particular murder of all kinds, mutilation, cruel treatment, and torture.
The report accuses the warring parties of targeting civilians through rape and other forms of sexual violence, arbitrary arrest and detention. Team member Joy Ngozi Azelo says women and children are among the main victims. She notes conflict-related sexual violence in Sudan has a long and tragic history and often is used as a weapon to terrorize and control communities. She says the RSF in particular has perpetrated these crimes on a large scale in Darfur and in the greater Khartoum area.
Victims recounted being attacked in their homes, beaten, lashed, and threatened with death or harm to their relatives or children before being raped by more than one perpetrator.
The chair of the fact-finding mission, Mohammed Chande Otman, says the true scale of the horrors being committed by the warring parties is yet to be known.
The gravity of our findings and failure of the warring parties to protect civilians underscores the need for urgent and immediate intervention. Our report, therefore, calls and recommends for the deployment of an independent, impartial force to protect civilians in the country.
The investigators also are calling on both sides to the conflict to comply with their obligations under international law and immediately cease all attacks on the civilian population. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A group called Concerned Gambians and Commonwealth Citizens has filed a petition to disqualify Gambian Foreign Minister Mamadou Tangara from becoming the next Commonwealth Secretary General. Madi Jobate is a human rights defender and spokesperson for the group. He also says because the foreign minister served as cabinet member of former President Yahya Jammeh's government, he should not be considered for the position. Local and international human rights groups accuse former President Jammeh and his government of committing human rights abuses during his more than 20-year rule. This after local media reports say Foreign Minister Mamadou Tangara is under consideration to be nominated to compete for the position of the Secretary General of the Commonwealth of Nations. Madi Jobate tells me that the decision makers in the Commonwealth should reject Tangara's candidacy.
When one understands how dictatorship operates, that Tangara at the strategic policy level, that is as a member of cabinet, Jammeh alone was not running the Gambia. He was running the Gambia assisted by a cabinet who were his key advisors, key assistants, key implementers of the entire regime at the time. And so we feel all those who are those key decision makers with Jammeh at the time must be held to account. It's unfortunate in the Gambia, though, until now you have Tangara and many people like him being brought back into the government, into the cabinet. We've raised our voices, and the political leaders, the president, of course, does not care about our voices. But anywhere the opportunity arises for us to hold any one of those people to account, we will do. And in the case of Tangara, it so happens that he is seeking the position of Secretary General of the Commonwealth. And for that purpose, it presents us an opportunity to stand up to voice this petition in order to hold him to account.
Some Gambians that I spoke with are of the view that Mr. Tangara's hands are clean. He has served the Gambia well as a citizen, and he has represented the Gambia well both locally and internationally. Serving the Gambia well should not preclude him from contesting for international positions such as the Secretary General of the Commonwealth. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I totally disagree. I think his hands are not clean. And people probably are looking at this in a very simplistic way. That is because he did not kill anyone or torture anyone. But Tangara represented that regime internationally, defended it. And that regime, it is very obvious by UN reports, by international organizations, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and so on, have reported acts of human rights violations perpetrated by that regime. So to go to represent that regime, cleansing it, legitimizing it, defending it, I think that is a huge crime.
Madi, what do you say to those who are saying that being the Secretary General of the Commonwealth brings honor to the people of the Gambia and West Africa as a whole? Preventing him from doing so is undermining the very essence of promoting the people of the Gambia.
Yeah, so that is the language of apologists, people who want to bury or obstruct accountability and justice. Gambia has dignity, and West Africa, but we need to put our best sons and daughters to represent us, to protect, to manifest our dignity, our honor.
What's next? After you get the signatures, then what next?
Well, we hope the Commonwealth of Nations, the people who make the decisions, we understand, of course, the Secretary General is selected by the head of state, would pay attention to this petition as a concern that is coming from citizens of Commonwealth. And so if they genuinely wish to make Commonwealth about the peoples of Commonwealth, the citizens of Commonwealth, they need to give attention to what citizens of Commonwealth are saying. And so I hope they will listen to this petition and act accordingly. They have all the information and they have all the resources and capacity to investigate, to verify what the petition is saying. And so what next is we hope that they will take it seriously and, uphold this petition and not vote for Mamadou Tangara. And that is it.
Madi Jobate, a spokesperson for the group called Concerned Gambians and Commonwealth Citizens. He spoke with me from the Gambian capital, Banjul. In Ghana, a civil society group is expressing concern about the integrity of the coming general election in December. This following the decision of the Electoral Commission not to allow a live broadcast of the meeting with the main opposition party, the National Democratic Congress, or NDC. The meeting is over allegations of anomalies in the provisional voter list. It comes as the electoral body compiles a final voter list to be used for the elections. The civil society group called Care for Free and Fair Elections contends that a live broadcast of the talks between the Electoral Commission and the NDC would enable the public to witness the electoral body's commitment to ensuring transparency and accountability in the coming polls. David Kumi is the executive director of Care for Free and Fair Elections Ghana. He tells me that by refusing to allow the live broadcast of the meeting, the Electoral Commission appears to have little concern for transparency in the way the voter list is compiled.
We are looking at the referee to ensure that the elections are free, fair, and transparent so that it meets international standards. So when we got hold of the document, a lot of people also called us, those who have gone to the exhibition, called on us reporting that they couldn't find their names. We realized that, yes, a lot of names have been duplicated. Name are same, age same, sex same, but voters' ID numbers were different. Then we wrote to the Electoral Commission. The Electoral Commission refused to acknowledge.
Why is this important for the Electoral Commission to allow for the broadcast of an engagement the officials of the Electoral Commission are having with a political party? Why is it important to be aired live?
Because it is of public concern. Now, what it will do is that it will enhance public participation and increase the trust in the electoral process. Secondly, it will also aid collective accountability and also stop any intentional potential manipulation. And then again, public involvement in our electoral processes allows for more oversight, okay? And it also tells us that the Electoral Commission genuinely is willing and ready to conduct a free, fair, and transparent elections. So these are the things we are looking at.
But David, the question a lot of Ghanaians are asking is, why should an engagement with a single political party be broadcast live? Where should they bend backwards just to accommodate one political party when all political parties engage the Electoral Commission without it being broadcast live?
You see, the issue at hand here, as we talk about, is of national interest. It is not an interest that ought to be covered. The register bears the names of Ghanaians, Ghanaian electorates, whose names have been omitted, whose names have been transferred without their knowledge and their participation, whose names have been duplicated, their pictures, names, and data have been duplicated. And the 1992 Constitution mandates the Ghanaian public, the electorates, to go to the polls, cast their ballot to elect an individual to become the president and other people to become member of parliament. So when it borders on the voters register, that bears the names of the general public. It is a public matter. It is not a private matter. And we find it very difficult to understand why the Electoral Commission is preventing the public to be involved. It is blocking inclusivity. It is blocking public participation.
But David, the Electoral Commission has put the provisional list out for prospective voters to inspect their information so corrections will be made ahead of the election. Why should it be an exclusive right or demand by the main opposition party for it to be broadcast live? This, a lot of Ghanaians are saying, does not make sense.
On the contrary, majority of Ghanaians in this country are willing and have the desire to want to see exactly the conversation between the political party and the Electoral Commission because of previous events. And if you care to know, I'll give you a few of them. There is a gentleman in this country who went to work, and his son, who is barely 15 years, was lured by a political party to go and register. So when the man had the information, he matched his son to the Electoral Commission and told the Electoral Commission that my son is barely 15 years, so he is not qualified to participate in the elections. The Electoral Commission gave the man assurance, took the details and said, we are going to delete your son's name from the register. It was not done. That is 2020. 2024, when the son was 18 and had gone to the polling center or registration center to register, his name was still in the register and he was caught as doing double registration. So we cannot trust the Electoral Commission alone to go through this. I'll give you another example. When you take the Afrobarometer report that was conducted by CDD in this country, it says that 89% of the Ghanaian people does not trust in the kind of democracy that is being handed to us. Even though they want elections, they don't trust in our elections. And 78% do not trust in the Electoral Commission and the electoral processes that the Electoral Commission leads us to. So it calls much to desire. Now, people want to see, people want to be part, people who don't want to leave the work just for the Electoral Commission because of what happened in the 2020 elections.
David Kumi is the Executive Director of Care for Free and Fair Elections Ghana. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. This year's Forum on China-Africa Cooperation ended with President Xi Jinping pledging $50 billion toward the continent and signing a $1 billion infrastructure agreement to upgrade a strategically important railway corridor. Kate Bartlett spoke to analysts who said that faced with increasing competition from the West, China wants to show it's still a major player in Africa.
President Xi told more than 50 African leaders gathered for a development forum in Beijing this week that the China-Africa relationship is now at its best in history. Despite China's economic slowdown, Xi pledged about $10 million more in financing for the continent than at the last Forum on China-Africa Cooperation, or FOCAC, in 2021.
They were clearly working to make the point that the relationship hasn't diminished. So they were pushing back, I think, against the kind of a narrative that China and the China-Africa relationship is shrinking.
That was Corpus van Staden of the China Global South Project, a South Africa-based think tank. While the money wasn't as much as China contributed pre-pandemic, Yunnan Chen, a researcher at London-based group ODI, said the deals made at FOCAC were still significant.
Even though we have seen a decline in Chinese financing in Africa, and we know that China is experiencing a lot of domestic financial troubles, there's still a very clear and very emphatic political commitment.
For several years, China was seen to be moving away from the massive infrastructure projects of the early years of Xi's trademark Belt and Road Initiative, widely known as the BRI, towards what it has dubbed Small is Beautiful projects. However, during the forum, she signed a massive infrastructure agreement with the governments of Zambia and Tanzania to revamp what's known as the Tazara Railway, which will link mineral-rich but landlocked Zambia with coastal Tanzania. Paul Nanchulia, a research associate with the Africa Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, said China's unwillingness to entertain infrastructure requests may be changing.
That would indicate that China does not want to be locked out of the infrastructure game, given what the U.S. is doing with the Lobito Corridor.
The Lobito Corridor is the first big infrastructure project in Africa the U.S. has undertaken in years. Washington is backing the refurbishment of the railway, which is also aimed at transporting critical minerals. It will stretch from Angola on Africa's west coast through the Democratic Republic of Congo and northern Zambia. Earlier this month, the U.S. announced it could be extended further to Tanzania. Other key areas of cooperation and investment at FOCAC include Beijing's unveiling of $140 million in military grants and training for thousands of African military personnel. Green energy was also a focus, with Xi announcing China's plan to launch 30 new clean energy projects across the continent. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com and look for us on all your favorite social media. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from African Collection. But first, now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. It is becoming increasingly difficult to formulate a united a narrative that is balanced and dispassionate whenever one talks about China's relations with China, so with Africa. And in this regard, it's true that there are competing narratives that tries to explain the relationships between Africa and China. More often than not, these problems arise whenever African states assemble in Beijing, or President Xi Jinping comes to Africa, whichever country. This is a contrast to the feeling that if Africans are meeting with Western countries, whether United States, United Kingdom, and European Union, oh, that's normal. You hear very little of the negative pronouncements. So that's why Africans have a problem. It is time for the African media in particular to formulate their own ideas and not rely on ideas and formulations that are done outside of Africa. For example, one should focus not on these negative formulations, but to look at what the African leaders themselves are saying today about their relationship with China. This is the first time I can see when African leaders have arrived in Beijing with a collective stand, no ambiguity. They say they are in China and working with China because they have a preference for China's modernization method. And also they said this China is the only major power that has pronounced itself as willing to move Africa to an industrial case. You never have that. There's going to be a major efforts from any other country. In a sense, what China is saying to the African continent, that they are prepared to launch a Marshall Plan in the same way as the United Nations and the United States, after the Second World War, launched a Marshall Plan to Europe, which helped to get Europe on its feet. Africans are also keen to say, many of the heads of state, even in attending this conference in Beijing, took time out to see how China is conducting modernization process. In this regard, African states are looking at what China has achieved in Latin America, or in Asia, or in Central Asia. They are missing development. So if it is good for all these countries in Latin America, in Asia, and North Central Europe, why is it so difficult to accept that Africa can rely on China? In the midst of some of the negative warning to Africa to beware of leaning too much to China, you have a situation, which is a fact, that many Western corporations are having stronger ties with China in the economic field. And when there was one attempt to dissuade them to do it by the issue of the equipment, the corporation said, oh, no. There is no way we are going to decrypt from China, because that is where we make our daily bread. And when they talk about de-risking, they said, no, we understand. And this forced many African leaders to pull back. And therefore, the narrative that China has pulled off, it says it is committed to African moderation. And by the way, this doesn't happen now. Mao Zedong, in his Thanks to Africa in 1971, noted that it was only Africa, when Africans gained strength in the General Assembly, the People's Republic was able to gain its rightful seat in the United Nations. China has put forward a figure of $50 billion in 3 years. Yes, there has been some nitpicking, but that is normal. People do that all the time. It is for Africans to sit down and have their own dialogue as how they can cooperate with China in a modernization process. Africa may want to recall that the states, the Pacific, Tonga, and all, they're going to China regularly to see how the process is made. But the advice to Africans and policymakers, you will get the backbiting, you will get the nitpicking. But as the ancient Arabian wisdom says, let the dogs bite because it is in their nature. But the caravan of reasoned judgment will march on. Thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. You're killing the boy, of course. You're killing the boy, of course. You're killing the boy. Extra pressure, baby, when you whine and pause. You're killing the boy, of course. You're killing the boy, of course. You're killing the boy. I had to put my life on pause and follow you. If I make you my business, I suffer no loss. Cause I'm in love and it's showing. No force, can't separate. Baby, no law, keep me away. I take you on tour. Pretty baby, I give you something to live for. My girl. Extra pressure, baby, when you whine and pause. Slow down.
Pesa, ah, no coco se cura mi. You say you wanna bam bam with me. You say you wanna chop my money. You say you wanna call me daddy. Oh, I can be a sugar daddy, mama. I can put you on top. Put you in a song. Yeah. Baby, chop and chop, don't stop. Cause you're the sauce on top. Baby,
extra pressure, baby, when you whine and boss. You're killing the boss.
Don't give me trouble, you get to me, lama, lama. This thing not be no man.
The life can just edge. So while you are in life, enjoy yourself. Because time wait for nobody. Because even time does not have time. So enjoy.
Our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington.
So go,
hey.
So go,
so go.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters and engineer Justin Thwaites, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a hunter that returns home with a cow is a thief. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.